You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, The ABC of SEM, exploring the single employer model from the perspective of the supervisor and training practice. Presented by Peter Rutherford, Dr. Daniel Wilson and Dr. Srishti Dutta. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future and their families.
I'm the CEO of the Rural Doctors Association of Australia, and we're actually really excited. We were strong advocates for the development of a single employer model, and I think it's really important that we understand that the terminology has been applied now to a couple of different scenarios. So I think it's really important as we start this discussion, we actually sort of identify what single employer model may mean, and it may mean different things to different people. And I think this is part of some of the challenge we have in having these discussions, because for a rural generalist who works in general practice and also in the hospital system currently, particularly under a GP visiting medical officer arrangement, they have two employers, and that's part of the challenge. They often have to negotiate contracts with two or have two separate contracts. And in each state, that can also have different complexity. In Victoria, where every district has a different remuneration arrangement in their hospital, it's challenging to understand what the remuneration package will be, not just for general practice, but for the hospital work. In New South Wales, they have a fee-for-service arrangement in the hospital, but at least they have access to information about what those sort of fees are. And then South Australia has a bit more of a structured award. So different states have different arrangements. So single employer aim to simplify some of that, have one employment arrangement, particularly for registrars, but I'll get into that a little bit in a minute. But also, I guess, recognising doctors that don't necessarily leave the state health system, but based on the employment arrangements that are available in their state, were basically being forced to enter into a contract arrangement and lose all their entitlements, even though they've never actually had a gap in service to the state. So where anaesthetic registrars or psychiatry registrars continue to accumulate leave entitlements throughout their training, a rural generalist working in Victoria or South Australia registrar basically was then in that private domain and no longer accruing those benefits, even though they continue to provide services within the state system. So that was identified by junior doctors in the rural setting as a potential barrier when they're choosing careers. And so the single employer concept was discussed and developed as part of the work that Professor Paul Worley did in the early stages of designing and establishing the National Rural Generalist Pathway. From the discussions around rural generalists, what emerged quite quickly was the need for employment reform for all GP registrars. And again, what are the barriers for general practice being an attractive career option? And again, the issue of accrued entitlements came up. You know, when all the other specialties are accruing these entitlements, it's not something that general practice has the benefit of offering, particularly ongoing entitlements from the hospital service years. So that has been identified as a barrier. The pilots that are currently in place are very much focused on the rural generalist model, particularly in Murrumbidgee and the Riverlands. Tasmania has some GP as well as rural generalist arrangements. But based on the feedback, the department recognised the need for the push that there needs to be broader reform for GP registrars as well. And they then engaged KPMG to do some scoping around portability of entitlements. And I'd certainly like to acknowledge Dan's work and the AMA's work in this space. And the KPMG report has given a number of recommendations for consideration. But I might hand over to Dan. Well, he was a registrar, he's now a fellow, so well done, Dan. But sort of some insights from his perspective and also probably a little bit more insight in the background to the work that the AMA did in that space as well.
Thanks, Peter. One of the motivating factors for the development of a single employer model from both the perspective of registrars and supervisors was occurring in approximately between about 30 to 50% of relationships between registrars and supervisors, whereby some supervisors actually had a financial stake in not only the supervision of that registrar, but also a stake in the business itself. So some supervisors, of course, practice owners. Registrars felt particularly uncomfortable with the power imbalance that that might present when one supervisor also owns the business, and was a real motivating factor for many registrars to support a model, an employment model, whereby once remuneration was kept completely distinct from their training experience. And ideally, in all other professions, when one is a learner, their remuneration should ideally be completely disarticulated from how quickly they are able to adapt to that learning circumstance. The AMA, the Australian Medical Association, worked diligently to hold a number of sessions over the last couple of years to canvass different perspectives on single employer model to move forward to this point today, whereby really at this stage, there are a number of pilots through which the state health system in each of these pilots. So there's one in New South Wales, there's one in South Australia, there's one in Tasmania. The state health service acts as the employer for the registrar, instead of the private practice acting as the employer. In all of these models, there are unique circumstances through which the flow of funding occurs. However, on the most simplest level, the registrar still sees patients in the private practice most days of the week, however, is likely to be also performing rostered work in the state health service in their relevant area where they're employed. The registrar will see the normal number of patients that they previously see and bill the patient appropriately, whether that's bulk billed or whether that's private. In all of these models, the practice is responsible for collecting the fees, whether that's private or whether it's bulk billed, and those fees are then dispersed to the state health service in a particular ratio depending on the relationship that's established in that single employer model. And each state pilot at this stage has established a different relationship as to how that's dispersed. The registrar receives a consistent salary, which is completely unrelated to the number of patients, completely unrelated to the number of billings that they receive. However, there may be scope for some models to advance that as to whether or not there's top-up payments permitted under those arrangements. At this stage, there's not. In the most developed model, which is the Murrumbidgee model from New South Wales, there seems to be very good retention of registrars within the region as they graduate and to receive their fellowship. And particularly in that region, the practices that are involved in that single employer model have also been rather satisfied with the model as well, which has resulted not only at the minimum bar, which should be cost neutral to any particular practice and supervisor, but actually has been a means through which the practice can financially support itself as well.
I'm just going to ask Dan and Peter if you could just add some detail to the models themselves in regards to the regions that they're based in and how the existing relationships between primary care and LDH or HHS were managed or developed.
So in relation to Riverlands, which is Paul Worley, he's been leading that work and he's got a very supportive CEO in that area that has helped facilitate the arrangements. So Paul, and I'm paraphrasing some of the information he's provided to us, the employment arrangement is only one part of their offerings in the Riverlands. And they talk about a whole of training experience. So it's not just about the remuneration, it's about a length of training contract. It is also an opt-in model. Neither practices nor registrars are forced or mandated to participate. It's a choice. And I think this picks up on David's comment as to there's a trade-off with the billings versus getting a salary at the hospital. And what the Riverlands model has definitely found is that it's really the individual registrar who, you know, based on their life circumstances, where they are in their life, as to which they prefer, whether they're preferring to go down the fee-for-service model, whether they're looking at a joint appointment model, or whether or not they're looking at a full salaried model. So it really is about choice, and certainly from a Rural Doctors Association perspective, and I'm pretty sure GPSA and other peak bodies, we've all talked about whether it's the pilots or even into the future, that the choice for both practices and registrars is really, really important. And, you know, people shouldn't be forced to participate if they don't want to. And particularly, I think registrars, that's important. I think for practices, eventually the market will lead you to make a decision, because if you can't recruit any registrars because you're not offering it, because they're all going to salaried model, you know, that will soon help you inform your decision, but not be forced. But I think the Riverlands model is about that length of training contract offering as well. So we're talking 5-year contracts. They're having a general practice experience as interns. They're having general practice experience as pre-vocational doctors in PGY2. So it sort of gets into David's second question about the, you know, how do they learn to bill and things like that, in that by the time they hit GP1 and they're actually in that thing of billing, they've already got quite a good exposure and experience to the general practice they're working in. And Paul's feedback was that, you know, his GP1 registrars are much more advanced than a new GP, you know, 2 or 3 registrar coming into these practices in relation to knowing how general practice works. None of the pilot sites have yet identified that the issues around billing been an issue, that, you know, practices seem to be doing very well in relation to the arrangements. I will flag Tasmania and Riverlands are using a 50-50 split. So 50% of the private billings are going back to the LHD to offset their salary, and then the practice keeps the other 50%. RDAA likes that type of model. We think that that sits better. We also think, though, that they're needs to be a maximum limit. The state certainly shouldn't be making money out of this arrangement. They should cover their costs if that's there. But we do think the financial risk should sit with the state, not with the practice. And that's really important. And I guess the early findings with the pilots are showing that the practices are doing well. They're comfortable with how things are progressing in relation to the billings. But certainly in our advocacy to government, it's certainly something that we are aware that that is a risk, that they may not generate enough revenue. And some registrars don't now to cover their costs, and there's additional support payments through the colleges and things like that, if you've got registrars that are on a remedial action plan and things like that. But overall, so far, the pilots are not proving that there is that risk to practice. Murrumbidgee's is a little bit different. They do a hourly like return on, so per hour they pay back the time the registrars in general practice, and that's worked for them so far. But in saying that, we are aware of issues in New South Wales where they've taken the Murrumbidgee contract and are looking to expand that out statewide. And even Murrumbidgee has flagged that that won't necessarily work because there was a lot of local input. And again, I think that that's a key part of the future development of these models, is that we do need that local leadership and that local, you know, context built into these arrangements.
A couple of things. So, Pete, you're talking about let's go to the Murrumbidgee and Riverlands models. What sort of numbers are we already talking about? How many practices are involved? How many registrars are in play, considering there are the 22 jurisdictional SEMs that have been granted here?
So Murrumbidgee started with 5 practices, and they've ended up with the Aboriginal Medical Service as well. So they've now got 6 sites, and basically they have registrars in each of those, you know, at different stages. So there is a small intake each year, but yes, they're building, but that's sort of where, how they're working. That's the number of sites they've got involved. Riverlands, I can't tell you the exact number of practices, but we're certainly looking at a few more trainees, but they're across the whole continuum, if that makes sense. They're starting at intern, and I think they have an intake of 4 or 5 across, and then progressing through their training pathway.
So 4 or 5 per term, Peter, you're referring to, or
from interns
per year as an intake. Year.
And they're getting those interns carrying into AGPT. Well, they're too early in the stage to gauge that.
Well, they've had people join at different parts of their training time. So certainly the feedback from Paul is that where they've had, you know, vacancies in the past, you know, they've had a much higher level of recruitment, significantly higher, you know. So South Australia on their rural pathway had struggled, and Riverlands is showing significant signs of recruitment improvement as a result of this pathway.
A comment and a question, but you talk about there being choice for the practices only up to the point where nobody's choosing to go with them to work under the NTCER. But also, we've got to kind of acknowledge here that we're talking about rural practices at the moment who already have established relationships with those hospitals. So it will be a loss to the community as a whole if their only option is to engage through the SEM. So I feel like there's a little bit of tension there as to what the choice is, whether there it's a bit of coercion that they would need to participate under the SEM. And I'm just some of the language I've heard from our members as to what they've been.
So there are registrars in the Riverlands model that are not under the SEM model. They're given that choice. So they're just doing in private practice, they're doing straight fee for service, and that's been their choice. There's a couple that have a procedural skill, and therefore they're doing their time in the hospital under the salaried model, but their time in the general practice under fee for service. So that's more like of a joint appointment, I would consider. And then they've got a number of them under the full salaried model where they're working across both environments on a salary. So, and I think that Riverlands shows that you can be effective. And one of the comments that was made today in an earlier meeting from one of the registrars, the practice that is the most popular is also the practice that offers the most flexibility and has facilitated the registrar's choices. And it's basically the combination of all three.
Does quality training come into that at all? Is that something that people discuss in this environment?
Certainly from a Rural Doctors Association perspective, that's absolutely paramount. This was, again, initially when we talk about the design and the concept, it was done as part of the National Rural Generalist Pathway. And I guess from our perspective, a key principle is that the practice and the local health service district, these are registrars, they need to honour their commitments and facilitate the training opportunities so the registrars can have, you know, a really rewarding and quality training placement. You know, there are key things that we need to make sure that don't happen, that, you know, under the jurisdiction model, that we aren't seeing the hospitals pull these registrars out of general practice and into the hospital if there's a workforce shortage. That shouldn't be tolerated. RDA, I think there should be a fairly strong position by the Commonwealth in that, that that should be seen as a breach of the arrangement and basically then question the ongoing approval of that, you know, model type thing. Like there needs to be some fairly strict guidance in this space, you know, so that practices are protected. And, you know, I've worked in hospital management and I know that, you know, that is a risk. Like it's when the hospitals do it, it burns relationships and it's really hard to recover. So, you know, there needs to be a lot of work done in some communities to rebuild trust. But this is an essential part of this model, is that we look after general practice. And it's the idea is that you build your workforce looking at the needs of the community, not just the hospital, under these models for an RG. I think, you know, we get into a different discussion when we're talking about GP registrars who aren't working in the hospital system.
I might direct my next question to Dan in regards to that, Peter, is just looking at the Tasmanian model, which is more of a jurisdiction model. Dan, do you feel like, I think you referred to the possible power perceptions and imbalance in regards to registrars and practice owners who are supervisors. In effect, we are bringing in one more relational aspect with a third relationship that a registrar and supervisor slash practice owner has to manage. Do you have any thoughts around what the risks around that might be?
This may answer some of the questions that have come through in the chat around comments that practices provide more than just payment of wages. They provide pastoral support and other aspects that any employer may provide. So in the Tasmanian Health Service model, the Tasmanian Health Service acts as the employer in the fullest sense. So if there are complaints that need to be escalated regarding the workplace, the employer is the Tasmanian Health Service and is responsible for those issues at the end of the day, and the practice is treated as a placement site. So the registrar would be required to articulate any particular concerns with their employer, which is actually the Tasmanian Health Service. So in that regard, for registrars, there does add in an additional layer of risk or complexity, and that there is a third player in the picture. However, day-to-day practice in single employer models will articulate that if there is a face-to-face issue, maybe there's a local dispute potentially between supervisor and registrar, that of course has in most cases been dealt with at the local level within the practice before needing to be escalated to a workplace relations matter. As always, you could imagine that adding in an extra player always brings in extra complexity, and that's something that can't be avoided when adding an additional layer or relation in the picture. However, the registrars that have spoken to me have not raised any particular concerns in any of the models through which they're participating, and the practices that are participating where they have supervisors that are not practice owners have also not raised any concerns with the State Health Service acting as the employer.
So leading on from that question, Dan, I'm just wondering if the practices are considering their readiness in terms of whether they are the right location where they could offer SEMs. Are there any current practices within that model that are supervisors that own their practices as well? And do you have any idea of the breakup of the numbers in the Tasmanian model?
I don't have data around the number of practices where a practice owner may also be a supervisor in training.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering in regards to, from what you said, I take away that if there were issues that were not locally managed, it would get escalated to the LDH or hospital in terms of workplace related issues. And registrars are making that choice. Are they aware that of the full consequences of what might be the situation if things were not to be handled within that situation?
Sure, I haven't had any direct feedback on a major issue that has had to be escalated to the level of a LHD or the employer. Of course, we're talking about general practice training, where many of the actual training issues from registrars will often be escalated first at the practice level and then actually be escalated to the college, the relevant training college. And often it will be dealt with at a college level because it is a training matter rather than, in most circumstances, as an issue, potentially not sufficient quality of education from a registrar's perspective, not sufficient supervision time or quality. What I'm referring to there, where there might need to be an issue that's raised with the employer, is truly an actual workplace related dispute, which may be underpayment of monies, for example, or potentially a breach of workplace policy or procedure. I've not had any of those circumstances raised with me directly as an area of concern, but contractually, those matters are meant to be dealt with the employer, which in the Tassie model is the Tasmanian Health Service.
Could just add to that, I think, too, these doctors are coming from the state health system, so it's not an unknown entity or process in relation to some of the HR management things. If anything, they're probably a little bit more familiar in relation to escalation and some of the arrangements there. Some of the other benefit that has been fed back is actually the support that the HR units in the LHDs are able to provide to general practice as well, in relation to, like as Dan said, particularly workplace related issues as opposed to training concerns and things like that. So I think there's, you know, some positives that registrars and supervisors and practices can benefit from, but it's not an unknown entity. These people aren't coming into these jobs, you know, with the district being a whole new thing to them. They're very familiar with the arrangements because they'll have worked under them for at least 2 years, if not longer.
There is a question, which is if a registrar moves out of the regional LHN or HHS or however we define it, do they then keep their benefits or lose them? And have you had any modelling around that in any of these current SEM pilots?
So a registrar will retain their existing entitlements if they're hospital employed entering into a single employer model region. So whatever they've accrued in the hospital system will be acknowledged and transferred into that model. I believe the question's articulating whether or not if they're in a single employer model and choose to move out of that model, those entitlements will only be acknowledged if they're transferring to an additional single employer model. However, I'm not aware of any particular registrar that has done that. If they move from one LHN to another LHN, so LHN1 is SEM, LHN2 does not offer SEM, those entitlements, of course, will not be necessarily acknowledged because they'll still be within the general practice training program and need to fall under the default arrangements, whichever are relevant within that LHN. And in LHN2, only the NTCDR would be applicable if that LHN doesn't offer a SEM. So those entitlements would be lost should that registrar choose to do so.
I'll just throw in there, if that was an RG, Dan, who has transferred to part of their part-time in the hospital space and their part-time in private practice, community setting, if they did transfer to a non-SEM arrangement and they still did their time in hospital, are those transferable, those entitlements from LHN to LHN? Is that across the country or is it only in some states? Because I know Victoria, we are the anomaly. Just how does that roll out?
Sure, I can answer that from my perspective and experience working within the Australian Medical Association. So within each jurisdiction, hospital registrars are able to transfer their entitlements between health services or LHNs, but do require a certificate from their actual employer to the next, and that is generally acknowledged and accepted. The same is true if moving between jurisdictions or territories. So let's say I'm moving from Victoria to New South Wales. I would ask my Victorian employer for a certificate of relevant entitlements and accrued leave and present that to my new employer. However, moving between jurisdictions and territories, there's no obligation for that to be honoured or acknowledged. However, in my experience, in most circumstances with relevant advocacy and support, that's been able to be transferred.
Who's done the advocacy in those instances, Dan? Particularly when it's been at the LHNs and HHSs as opposed to practices involved, is what you're referring to?
Certainly. So for registrars that have moved between jurisdictions or territories, that advocacy has either been performed by RDAA or Australian Medical Association, so an organisation with relevant bargaining experience to help that individual bargain with the LHN or HHS, because it's a matter within the state health service, not within the private practice.
That to us is really key, isn't it, Srishti, is where the organisation that we have a very strong principle about the end point of training, if it's going to be a private practice or a state-funded community practice, the primary healthcare has to remain strong. It's not just about the acute location, obviously. This is what our country relies on. So looking at the modelling for the single employer model, which was, you know, through what you're saying and what I've heard through different areas, is very much around the rural generalists and empowering good training into the different areas of rural generalism specifically. Where does the privately owned business of general practice fit into that modelling? Has it been actually looked at as a core focus? Registrars are not all wanting to be employed into the future. Yes, there are some, and this is perfect, but there are those who would like to be a partner in a practice or own their own practice into the future and want to make sure that that's an opportunity for them. Has that been modelled? Like, is there an actual modelling that's been done?
That's the model we have now, where people have that option. And I guess what we're looking at is there's quite a large cohort out there that's not an attractive option and they're choosing something different. So the idea of SEM, and whether it's RG or even a GP registrar employment reform down the track, is looking at what is a model or models that support people who find that the current model isn't offering what they want and therefore they're choosing something else, or, you know, staying in the hospital system, whatever it might be. And so I think, you know, we've got the model now where we can encourage people who are a little bit more entrepreneurial or thinking about owning a small business. But we also know for rural, that's challenged, and that's been our focus. That's been, you know, again, part of the challenge in that a lot of registrars are saying that's not what they want. But I think, again, it's really about that thing of having that balance and having that choice is absolutely key. And what we want to make sure is that under these models is that we don't put at risk the viability of community-based general practice. That needs to remain strong. where certainly from an RDAA perspective, we are very committed to making sure that community-based general practice or service in like Aboriginal medical services remains a key focus of these models, so that we're not looking at creating a team of people that only work in hospitals or in hospitals or only work in their area of advanced skill. This is about, you know, rural generalists as one part, as for one model, and having them work in community-based general practice or in an Aboriginal medical service and working across their whole of scope. For community general practice as well, I think, you know, the issue around portability of entitlements is a real one. It's a barrier for a lot of, you know, doctors choosing to choose general practice. And it's something that needs to be addressed. And yes, you can earn some good money and you get that percentage and in lieu of, you know, accrued entitlements. And for some, that's fine. But we also need to look at the changing demographics of our workforce. You know, we've got just as many women, or if not more women, in general practice than men. But even men want to have time off when their partner has children. Like, it's not just, hate when people say it's the feminization of the workforce. Mums and dads want to have time off when, you know, they're starting a family. So I think, you know, depending on individuals' life choices or, you know, their individual circumstance, a salaried model or that importance of that portability of leave is really important. We can have a model that supports entrepreneurial and that sort of thing. That's what we've got now. And I'm not saying that the indexation and all that, I'm not saying the Medicare rebates are perfect, but the model we have is one that can support and facilitate that we have now. But we certainly don't have a mechanism without single employer or, you know, reform to support registrars to have an alternate choice. And I will flag, not just registrars, like we've had it, you know, discussed at the department, that while these pilots and even the scope of the work that KPMG did around GP employment reform, you know, we've all flagged that once these doctors fellow, there'll be still a cohort of them that are looking for continuation of that arrangement beyond fellowship. So while the pilots and that are, you know, focusing on registrars because it's kept the scope controllable, I think, you know, it's certainly something on the radar for the department that there will be a cohort of doctors that want a salaried model beyond fellowship.
So here's a question from Frank Maldari. What are the rights of practices in terms of terminating the placement of the registrar? And will the practices be indemnified from action for unfair dismissal in circumstances where that might apply?
These arrangements will, well, through a jurisdiction model, are all mapped out as part of the memorandum of understanding. And it will be about good communication between the practice and the hospital or the local health district in relation to, you know, performance and management of a registrar's performance. And if it's a serious breach where dismissal, you know, from the practice would be the preference, well, there may be a remedial or plan put in place by HR of that local health district. But I think there will be elements that are articulated in the memorandum of understanding as you go through and work through with the local, you know, human resource team as well. But for any serious concerns around performance or behaviour or anything like that, there will be very clear pathways of escalation within the district, and then the district have a range of mechanisms, you know, that if that registrar and practice haven't clicked, that they may be able to facilitate a placement elsewhere or additional support. So I think there's certainly mechanisms to address it, but I think there's also good protections for the district, there's good protections for general practice, and there'll be good protections for the registrars.
That leads on to the next one, which is, what are the obligations of the employer to the practice, i.e. if the registrar leaves during a term due to illness or they change their mind, does the employer, i.e. referring to the LHD in this instance, have any obligation to supply a replacement workforce to the practice in the community, which then loses that capacity of providing care to their patients?
Look, I think some of this will be worked out within the individual MOUs. My initial instinct is what happens now. If you've got another registrar who's willing to come, you'll get them. But if they don't, it would be very difficult for the district to supply you with another doctor. There may be some provision for additional support, but I think at the moment with the numbers that we're looking at, that wouldn't be the case. But similarly, that's not the case now under the current arrangement. So it may get better, but it's not going to get any worse.
There's a question regarding the involvement of the colleges in terms of SEM.
I'll leave the colleges to speak for themselves. Both colleges have been engaged in the development and the consultation. The thing what we can all agree on is there was a need for reform. And certainly, you know, the discussion today that we've had, or yesterday we had National Council of Primary Care Doctors, we all talked about the need for choice, and that opt-in is a key element. The department under their pilot, that's been a condition of participating in the pilots, is that practices and registrars have not been forced to participate. It's been an opt-in option through the pilots. Certainly from an RDAA perspective, we expect that to be maintained beyond just the pilots. If it is rolled out nationally in some level, we would still expect choice to remain a key thing.
This is a question. I understand there needs to occur a change in the Medicare Act to allow revenue from billings within Medicare to pass on to the state. Is this still a stumbling block that has to be fixed before further expansion of the SEM beyond pilots? And I guess it's referring to the 19(2) exemptions.
I believe that is referring to the 19(2) exemption of the Health Insurance Act. If that's been clarified by the Commonwealth, that exemption is not required under a single employer model under all circumstances. It simply depends on the model that's being applied. So a reasonable resource to answer those questions is actually from the Tasmanian Health Service single employer model website, which will probably answer a lot of questions.
I'll just add that the 19(2) part of the Health Insurance Act basically says you can't claim Medicare if you're being paid a salary by the Commonwealth or the state. So the exemption is the thing that then facilitates that. There are a number of places where 19(2) exemptions already exist, either under COAG or RRMBS. The other part too is that when this issue was first discussed with Paul Worley as part of the Rural Generalist Pathway when he was in the commissioner role, we talked about whether it's a 3GA program mechanism similar to, you know, everyone's favourite PGPPP, or what would the requirements be? And the department spent a lot of time and a lot of money, I dare say, on lawyers going through all the legislation and looking what would be the mechanism to facilitate this. And they landed on the 19(2). And as Dan said, it's not necessarily required in every arrangement, but it's certainly required for some, and particularly where you're working like with all your hours are salaried and you're billing Medicare, then there would be some mechanism to be required, whether it's a SEM 19(2) or whether you're working under a COAG or our MBS, but there need to be some provision.
I mean, it's human nature to take the path of least resistance, irrespective of who we are and how much effort we appear to say we make. Having Merck in many models, including salaried prior to coming to Australia, one of my concerns is why would a registrar want to see more patients if a community demand is high, if there are only increased efforts on their part required and there's no real incentive for them, given that as far as I recall, Dan, you mentioned the number of patients seen is not necessarily included or factored into this outside of or including for quality of training. What, if any, incentive is there for them to see or provide a service to the community in which they're working by way of quantity metrics as well as quality metrics?
Yeah, certainly. It's a common question that's raised, and on face value, it's really actually quite a valid question. I work as a sole contractor. It actually suits my lifestyle, as Peter's mentioned. It depends on your lifestyle and your circumstances. I suppose I would flip that question on its head, and the corollary would be that any salary doctor therefore doesn't work very hard and has no motivation to see a lot of patients. So an example would be, why would any state employed inpatient team look to be able to see all of their 40 inpatients within one day in develop management plans? Or why would an emergency physician have any incentive to see the total waiting room of 30 patients that need to be cleared they're not being paid fee for service, yet they still work incredibly diligently hard to meet the demands of their service. The second point that I would suggest that any registrar, should they be employed under a single employer model, there may not be an incentive, but under any workplace, there are performance management measures in place. So let's say, for example, I'm a registrar working under a single employer model. I'm happy getting my salary. I can see one patient. I can see 10 per hour. It doesn't matter how many I see. I'm still going to get the same amount of money. He is my manager, but potentially at the health service, who's my employer, and Carla is my practice manager at the placement site. I would imagine that Carla would be rather concerned for my work performance, which may have been raised by the supervisor. One patient an hour, that's really not a suitable way to work. You're not meeting your expected standard. And indeed, we need to put in place a performance management plan that would be developed between the supervisor and the practice manager in this case, which is Carla. Let's say that performance management plan were inadequate to meet the demands, then it would be within the rights of obviously the placement site. So Carla being the practice manager would escalate that to the employer of the registrar, which is Peter in this case. And then it would be incumbent on Peter to undertake relevant performance management of me as an employee. And if I'm not meeting the expected performance, then an appropriate outcome may be that I'm further managed or potentially look to be even terminated if should I not even meet simple performance requirements of the role. That has never come to fruition in any of the models, but it's a valid question around incentive to work.
Can I follow up that question then, Dan, with, you know, our current system with regards to ED and outpatient weights, certainly in terms of the length of waits and the increasing waits is not reflective of its efficiency as opposed to access within general practice. Should we anticipate that that's likely to happen within general practice as well, i.e. there will be a disproportionate burden on practice owners in terms of the work to meet that demand within the community as opposed to an employed registrar?
It's certainly a valid concern. I mean, only time will tell what's going to happen out of these models as to whether or not the number of patients seen by doctors working under a single employer model are lower than those numbers seen by doctors working in sole trader or contracting arrangements. However, that data is not yet available even through evaluation nor for public consumption. So that's the purpose of these models, to be able to articulate what are the benefits and risks to the community and ultimately service the nation's needs.
One of the questions that came through was, is it possible that this will be rolled out nationally? I can see that the majority of the pilots at this stage are regionally or rurally located. Are there any pilots occurring in MMM1 areas at this point?
All of the pilots at this phase of the interest from the Commonwealth's perspective have been for rural parts of Australia, particularly focusing on rural generalists. However, in the consultation period with KPMG, who are the successful tender for that piece of work, specific questions were asked of relevant stakeholder group for two questions. One, where else might a single employer model be successful or work? So will it be possible to roll out to non-rural areas such as metropolitan? At this stage, there has been no indication to roll a single employer model out to a big MMM1, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane. However, there have been relevant discussions as a potential utilisation of a single employer model in areas of workforce need or particular shortage. So maybe Western suburbs, Melbourne, Western suburbs, Sydney, just depending on the region, and determining those areas of need would be for further discussion. There are no current pilots outside of rural areas at this phase.
What is the role of training programs in terms of performance management issues? Hasn't been discussed in much detail here. And most of this is referring to rural training. What about metro streams? You've answered the second part of that for us, Dan. The question is regarding what role will the colleges play in terms of performance issues in the SEM models? How is that, you know, delineated with regards to the employer versus the training performance?
I'll declare a conflict. I'm a board director of the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine. From the perspective of any college, both colleges play no role in the employment contract negotiations between employee and employer. So if there are workplace-based performance matters, that's certainly an issue that needs to be resolved at the level of employer and employee. And in a single employer model, that now involves also a placement site, i.e. the practice. Colleges would be certainly willing to receive feedback from registrars, supervisors, practice managers, or employers through any of those models and assist where possible. But if it were a matter of performance, in the most basic sense, not seeing enough patients, that would be a matter for the training placement site and employer. Under the training conditions for the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine, there are no minimum number of patients to be seen per hour. However, under the training requirements for the Royal Australasian College of General Practitioners, there are minimum number of patients to be seen. So in those circumstances for the RACGP, that may be a relevant matter for the RACGP to intervene in a particular underperformance for minimum number of patients.
I might take the opportunity to flip that one on its head and say if there isn't a minimum number in regards to patient seen, particularly in the context of ACRM and RG, are there any maximum or fatigue management issues that have been considered both for the registrars and supervisors?
Both colleges have policies around fatigue management for registrars and supervisors.
Irrespective of that being a SEM model.
There would be no reason why fatigue management procedures or policies from either college would not be applicable regardless of the employment model, whether or not that is a single employer model or whether or not that is an existing employment model. Those policies and procedures are able to be applied in all contexts as they are approved training sites under AGPT, RGTS programs.
I think too, under a jurisdictional model, where the jurisdiction, most state awards have fairly stringent fatigue management arrangements in place, and it probably offers additional protections. And I think certainly in the rural circumstance, a lot of the overtime or recall is as a result of hospital work. So therefore, you know, it should be the hospital that incurs those penalties. But the state awards offer a significantly greater level of protections around fatigue management than probably any private arrangement that would be sitting in general practice.
If they're in the hospital on an RG shift and then they've had to work a double shift, they've had to work over, create an opportunity to create some form of fatigue management policy.
Yeah, look, I think in relation to, there's arrangements now where we see rural generalists, particularly in a fee-for-service model, where they're in the hospital all evening and they've got a whole day of patients booked the next day, and that's a challenge. For a registrar, you know, one of the challenges is if they don't go into general practice, they don't earn any money for that day either. So for RGs, it's, you know, this is part of the issue. The industrial award will take care of that because they'll be on penalty rates or whatever. They'll have fatigue arrangements in place if they work because they have to. Then there's generally fatigue provisions. And each state's different. I know Queensland has like a 10-hour break in service from the end of one shift to the start of the other, or you incur penalties. But within the MOU, there needs to be provisions in place to protect the practice. So it may be things around, you know, the call and how then, you know, the roster works the next day. It may be around, is there some sort of payment provided should the patient day be cancelled completely as a result of hospital work? And at the moment, that may happen every now and then. If it happens once a week for a month, well, then the practice is definitely being impacted by hospital work. There needs to be protections in place in the MOU that is between the practice and the LHD. So that's certainly something that's come up in the New South Wales agreement, and RDAA and RDA New South Wales and the AMA and everyone else will provide that feedback, because those protections are really, really important.
And Peter, you'd see those protections being extended to the GPVMOs that are supervisors as well, in addition to the registrars?
Yes. I mean, there's a whole range of benefits, and I'll flag this. We hear a lot of issues around the payment of the supervisor under the fee-for-service model, because you can only pay that for that service once for the hospital work. These models take care of that, because the registrar will be on a salary. So even if the fellow is on a fee-for-service, they can then bill that item number. So this actually takes care of the issue about supervisors not getting paid. So again, that's probably a benefit. But I think, yes, if there's elements that extend, we need to think about that as part of probably a VMO contract arrangement negotiation as opposed to this. But if it ends up the supervisors are on a salary, yes, those provisions would apply.
As a concept that's being rolled out quickly and in a time of great change, that we don't let the training practices and supervisors get lost in this mix, and we don't get sucked into a dialogue that's talking about dollars in the general practice that are actually patients in our community. So uncoupling some of those things, and we'd like to work with RDAA and ACRM to ensure that this is for the benefit of all of our communities. Some of the things that people talk about, and we just want to get out right. So, and we're just going to run our little reminder. This is one way that we communicate with everybody. The GPSA community platform, all free for our members who have no membership fees to start with. So use the spaces that we've created for you to communicate with one another, because it's a very hard space to network in such isolated pockets of the world. Our role here is to bring people together, get the answers everyone needs, and see what we can do going forward together. So thanks heaps, Peter and Dan and Srishti. I thank you so much for your time, and we'll speak very soon.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.